Good evening, and welcome aboard Seascapes, the Maritime Programme.
And indeed, good evening, and welcome to Seascapes, where we're 30 years old this year. That was Tom McSweeney introducing one of the very first editions of this programme 30 years ago. We've been going steady ever since, and tonight I thought I'd look back at some of the archives from all those years and bring you a few highlights. First, our regular contributor, Hugh Oram, who's been here almost since the start, has been looking back at the history of Seascapes.
It's just 30 years since Seascapes first took to the airwaves in 1989, and it's been going strong ever since, after a rather rocky start. The first presenter was Tom McSweeney, and he says that he was fortunate that a fellow Corkman, Kevin Healy, was then the director of radio at RTE. Tom put the case for a maritime programme to Kevin Healy, who then accepted the need for such a programme. It started in a very modest way, just 15 minutes during the summer schedules, before it was expanded into the half-hour slot it occupies today. Tom McSweeney says that the programme succeeded, despite the fact that after Kevin Healy moved on from his job in RTE, others in the station weren't so well disposed towards the new programme. As Tom says, the programme kept moving around the schedules, but the disbelievers never succeeded in dislodging it. Not everyone in RTE was maritime friendly, he recalls, but fortunately, listeners soon took to the new maritime programme and were quick to voice their approval. Tom McSweeney says that he thinks he proved that an island nation deserved a maritime programme, and its survival has proved that his development of it set a headline to be followed. Tom retired from the programme and from RTE exactly a decade ago in 2009, but he is still broadcasting and writing about maritime affairs. He was followed as presenter and producer by Marcus Connaughton, who had been working as the programme's producer. He says that making the programme was a particular pleasure, made all the more enjoyable by the listener feedback and by the many volunteers whom he featured on the show. Members of many maritime-related organisations took part, including people from the RNLI, the Inland Waterways Association of Ireland, the Irish Coast Guard, the Sea Scouts, the Irish Sailing Association and Civil Defence, as well as from the many sub-aqua clubs along the coast. Great support for the programme came from the boating, fishing, rowing, swimming and yachting communities throughout Ireland. Marcus says that traversing inland waterways or visiting coastal communities always brought a rich harvest of stories for broadcast. He says that during his time in front of the microphone, highlights included the annual Sail Training Awards and interviewing the youngsters who took part, the opening by President Michael D. Higgins of the former Mariners' Church in Dunlera as the National Maritime Museum, and most especially speaking with Jimmy Tyrrell from Arklow on the pier at Bundoran as the first Shannon-class lifeboat came into service in Ireland. Under Marcus's command, one of the highlights was the publication in 2014 of an excellent book produced by the Liffey Press called Sailing By that celebrated 25 years of Seascapes. Undoubtedly, the most important technical advance in the programme's history was putting the contents of the show online so that maritime enthusiasts around the world with access to the internet could tune in online. And while the programme has built up such a devoted maritime listenership both here in Ireland and around the world, it remains the only such maritime radio programme broadcast in these islands, a unique achievement indeed. After Marcus retired, Fergal Keane, who has long worked with RTE, took over the presentation and production of the programme. And apart from the three people who've presented Seascapes during its 30-year-long existence, the programme has long been noted for a wide variety of contributors from all sections of the maritime environment. One of the most distinguished of those contributors was the late Dr. John de Courcy Ireland, who died 13 years ago. He had an encyclopedic knowledge of maritime matters, not just around Ireland, but around the world, backed up by many life-changing experiences, such as when he was a teenager sailing as a cabin boy on a ship destined for South America. I remember vividly one occasion on Seascapes when he described the involvement of the French in their colonial struggles in North Africa. Marseille, then and now, is the main port in southern France for shipping services to North Africa. And Dr. John de Courcy Ireland gave an incredible description of Marseille, including the fact that when you come out of the railway station there, the views out over the port are absolutely incredible. Sometime after that, my wife and I arrived in Marseille, got out of the train and went round to the front of the station at the top of its many steps leading down to the city. The view was absolutely as he had described it, an amazing example among many of maritime descriptions broadcast on Seascapes coming to life in very vivid and tangible form. It's almost invidious to name just some of the contributors over the years, the likes of Winking Nixon, a great sailing enthusiast, Norman Freeman, and Jason Woolley. Many distinguished female contributors have included Lorna Siggins from Galway, who continues to work for the programme. Daphne Pochin Mould, who died in County Cork 5 years ago at the age of 93, made many unique contributions. She was born in Salisbury in southern England, but she and her parents moved to Ireland in 1951. She lived at Aherlar, just west of Cork City, and apart from her great interest in the sea, she also loved flying and did a huge amount of aerial photography from her plane of most of the southern part of this island. Indeed, such a rich body of contributors to the programme over the years. I had been working on other programmes on RTE Radio, but in the autumn of 1993, I jumped ship to Seascapes, and it has been a pleasure and a privilege to have contributed to the programme ever since. Truth to tell, Ireland has an incredible store of maritime lore and stories, and due to the dedication of Seascapes over the past 30 years, the programme has provided a vital and constantly refreshing link between its listeners and Irish maritime affairs during all that time.
Hugh Oram with a little bit of the history of this programme, 30 years old. For tonight's programme, I've gone back and looked at the archives from 1989 and picked out a few items. The first is this interview from 1991, when Tom McSweeney met master boat builder Joe Murphy. Joe was born in 1928 and he spoke a bit about his boatyard and his work.
The grandfather died in 1946. He left the entire business to me. And an unfortunate thing happened. In 1948, I got a compulsory purchase act to close down the site. I fought that and I beat it. I got another one in 1949 and I beat it too. And in 1950, I got a government order. And the yard had to go. And the reason I had to go was this. We were working hammering tongs there in 1949. And the only time we stopped work was on Christmas Day. Just that one day. It was really flying. For the simple reason is this. After the war, a lot of people got big gratuities out of the British Army. And they entered into the sailing scene, whereby they squeezed the old gentry type out and the ordinary working man could have a boat. And with the result, this business expanded to such an extent we couldn't cope with it. And that's the reason we only closed down on Christmas Day. Now in 1950, we got this government compulsory order saying we weren't given enough employment for the area we covered. And I had to surrender the site. I closed down the yard, scrapped all the machinery, sold it off, went full time to the Dublin Port and Docks Board. And 3 years later, I discovered they put 8 blocks of flats for the Dublin Corporation on the same site that I had for my grandparents. And that hurt me very, very bad. But looking out here now, as I am sitting here on this rock, and looking out on Dublin River, and looking at the Galway Hook at the Morning Star, I said to myself, there is something to be proud of. and I'd like to take part in that. And the last thing I do, I'll build those boats as long as I live.
You also have another proud tradition in that you were the last shipwright diving, effectively. And the bell, I gather, is still in the Dublin Port and Docks yard from that.
I was. I started diving in Dublin Port and Docks Board in 1952 in the diving suit during general dock work. And in 1954, then, I joined the diving bell. Now, the diving bell was the last bell in the British Isles. As such, it originally was brought down from Newry, I believe, to Dublin Port some ages ago. But we used to use it here for leveling off the seabed here, for the building of Ocean Pier, number 1, number 2, number 3, and number 4 Eilbert, and South Bank Quay, and the lead-in jetty. Now, the diving bell, as compared to diving suit, in the diving suit, of course, you're locked up in a helmet and an armoured suit. In the diving bell, you get down your own clothes. The diving bell is 20 foot square on the bottom, 10 foot high, electric lights. It's got a tower 44 foot high. You enter the top chamber, 2 men at a time. And after entering the chamber, you shut the top door over your head. You compress and the bottom door falls open. You descend down into the bell. You land on the seabed.
Were you ever worried about it, Joe, when you were down there?
Not really. The only thing that ever worried me there was if I had a head cold. And the greatest remedy I had for that was Beecham's powders. You took about 6 Beecham's powders, and that would survive for the 5 hours.
And the diving bell mentioned in that interview is on display now on Dublin Docks. The next archive clip is from a man, Gerald Butler. Gerald was a lighthouse keeper and the author of a book, The Lightkeeper. He did duty on many lighthouses along the South Coast, the Skelligs, the Fastnet and others. In this first interview, he tells how he met Mark Spitz on the Skelligs. It was 1972. Spitz was on his way to Munich to win 7 gold medals.
Firstly, yes, he was the most perfect specimen of man I have ever seen. And he had the good looks, he had everything. I remember on the Skelligs when he came out, he was a lovely, lovely fella. And we had great fun with him. We used to go down to the landing and meet him when the boat had landed. For 2 days in a row, he came out with another gentleman. He was on his way to Munich. And we didn't know who he was. We knew nothing at all about him. We were just having a bit of crack with him, you know. And I remember when he stood on the landing and he was just about to dive in. And there would have been about 120 or 30 people on the rock that particular day. And everybody froze just looking at this. It's like as if he were sculpted. He was absolutely just perfect. And then he dived into the water and he left a wake as he went through the water. He was moving at such speed. It was phenomenal just to see him go. And he swam out quite a distance, turned around and swam back in again. I remember when he came out of the water, he said this is the coldest water he had ever been in. Anyway, it was beautiful weather. We were fooling around and messing away with him and having a bit of crack. And a lad there from the hook, a good friend of mine, Pat Kennedy, Pat picked me up and just fired me in to the off the steps of the landing. And it's good deep water there around the rock. So I went down and decided I'd try swimming across the mouth of the landing. And when I did, I managed to get all the way across, which was a good long trek. And when I surfaced on the far side, I was chuffed with myself because I had done what I didn't think I could do. I remember when I came up to the surface, I had a thumping headache because I had held my breath for so long. Anyway, I swam back and I noticed Mark about 10 minutes later. He dived off and I was watching him. Down he went and he decided to swim underwater across. and he surfaced maybe halfway or maybe even less than that. He couldn't hold his breath that long underneath, and he had to surface. And honest to God, I just laughed. I said to myself, I knew he was fantastic because I had been watching, but I just said, yeah, man, I did it. But it wasn't really a competition as such. Mark was measuring himself, and I think I was the yardstick. Do you know?
Gerald was on duty on the Fastnet Lighthouse the night of the Fastnet disaster. It was 40 years ago this year, and some years ago, Gerald looked back on that evening.
During that storm, the yachts started coming, and they'd come in waves, and there'd be loads of them, and then it'd be a bit quiet for a while, and then there'd be more yachts coming, and the weather was deteriorating rapidly. And I remember we locked up the door at the bottom of the lighthouse. We knew that the sea was going to at least come up around the door. And so the door's down in the bottom of the lighthouse. There are stormproof doors, and they're waterproof. So when we locked up the doors anyway, and we came on in, now we had seen we would experience weather way worse than what we were going to experience. I mean, this was the month of August. We came up the tower, but we were very, very, we were talking a lot about these lads at sea were going to be in a lot of difficulty. True enough, as the night progressed, the weather kept deteriorating, and the sea started to get higher and higher and higher. Soon it was breaking right up over the rock. We'd stand out on the balcony with a big Aldous lamp, and we would shine the Aldous lamp onto the yachts. We'd read their sail numbers, and we would radio that information to the lightkeepers in at the mizzen head. This was a traditional way that this had grown. Of course, they would send that information to the organisers back on Cowes. A yacht had come on. We switched into the distress frequency, and a yacht would come on and say, I'm after passing a yacht. It was turned upside down. No sign of life. And then another fellow would come on and say, we're after passing another yacht, and there's people clinging on to the sides of it. And then there would be loads more coming on and saying they're seeing distress flares. And distress flares must have been going up like fireworks all night, do you know. And this is all that they had. They didn't have the VHF radios, and some of them didn't have the HF sets that we were using, you know. But we just we could do nothing on the Fastnet, only just monitor them and radio our information into the mizzen. Now, that was a good thing in itself, because by doing that, there was a record kept. And it was the only record of a lot of the yachts. So at least we had that. But I remember during the night having to stop shining the Aldous lamp onto the yachts, because it was we felt it was so bright that it was dazzling the crew members. You must remember when the sea broke over the rock, standing on the balcony, it would obliterate our entire view beneath us. And I remember the wave would just break right up under the balcony. And the tower, of course, would vibrate and, jump around a bit. But you'd lose sight of everything, absolutely everything. All you'd see is water moving at a phenomenal rate right across underneath the lighthouse. And the noise, the roar of the wind, the crash of the sea. It's just when I say it now, it keeps coming like that. And then you'd see the yachts below. When the wave would crash down, you'd see the yachts below, and they were left in all this water tumbling all around them, you know. And lads there would be holding on to the rails or holding on to something until the water fell off the decks of the yachts, and they would pull themselves off up onto the bow to either pull in, trim up the sail, or whatever they'd have been doing, you know, and make their way back into the cockpit again, you know. I remember four yachts came together, and they were quite sizable yachts from the east. And I remember they weren't able to turn. The wind had shifted. I think the wind had shifted to the west, and they weren't able to turn at the Fastnet. They had to move weighing under Crookhaven, under the shelter of the land, to turn the yachts, their four yachts, and still they stayed in the race. I was amazed to see them coming back out again. That was how the night progressed, and there was 15 people drowned in the during the whole night, during the sequence of what was going wrong. Some yachts were turning head over heels, their bow would dip into the water and they'd just flip right over, do a cartwheel. Other ones then were just going broadside on and they'd lie into the water and go upside down and come up the other way around. And they might do that three or four times. So yeah, they got a desperate hammering.
And Gerard was honoured this year on the 40th anniversary of the disaster at a ceremony in Cork. In the early days of this programme, women were few and far between in the maritime sector. But one person who was a regular contributor was a woman, Daphne Poachin Mould. As mentioned earlier by Hugh Orme, she was a hugely accomplished woman, traveller and an adventurer. When she died 5 years ago, Seascapes got this piece from the archives from 1961. Here she tells of a trip in Scotland to the Rock of the Saints and the footsteps of St. Columbkill.
The place I was trying to get to was an island, a little inaccessible island in the Scottish Hebrides in the Firth of Lorne. One of the few Scottish islands with still standing ruins of buildings of the Celtic Church. Maybe the island that Adam Norn in his Life of Columbkiller called Hinbar. And if Eilidh Kinnaird, the Rock of the Saint, is Hinbar, an exciting place. But there, Columbkiller came often visiting from nearby Iona. There he once celebrated Mass in the presence of a little group of Irish saints, Brendan of Clonfert, Comgall, Canis, and Cormac. And at the consecration, Brendan saw a blazing light over Columbkiller's head. I'd seen the islands, the Garbarlachs, of which the Rock of the Saint is one, rising in sheer cliffs from the sea in the Firth of Lorne. Now I'd got in touch with a boatman on a bigger island to take me there. I was living then in the central parts of the Highlands, nearly 100 miles from the Rock of the Saint. And so early one morning, he said the sea was calm, though he thought there would be showers. I set off and drove hard through the Scottish hills, past Oban, and then over that little bridge which, in spanning a creek between the mainland and Seal Island, spans the Atlantic. At least that's the joke about it. I drove across Seal Island to Coan Sound, and there I had to leave the car and take the ferry over the narrow channel between Seal and Nuing, another island. Here a car was waiting for the delivery of the island's newspapers, and they gave me a lift on the road down to a crossroads about a mile from where the boatman lived. I walked the rest, and soon we were heading out among the many islands of this part of the Scottish coast to the Rock of the Saint. There are four Garbarlach islands with little offshore rocks as well. An hour's sail took us to the furthest, the Rock of the Saint. Not very far south is the Scottish tide race of Cardiff Rechan with its whirlpools. None of these waters are easy sailing. The Rock of the Saint's landing place, named after Columbkiller, is a narrow slit in the rocks into which one glides the boat with the motors stopped. Hands and boat hook onto the rock face, and you are there. Of course, in the old days, a curragh could easily have been lifted up the tiny shingle beachhead. But once you are there, you seem to have arrived in a second paradise. The showers were past and the sun was out. Rising on every hand from the sea were the famous islands of the west, Mull, Jura, Eilidh, Colonsay, and the mountains of the mainland to the east. The little island, about a mile in length, which seems a bleak, rocky lump when you look at it from the hills of Mull, is really a miniature world of little hills and valleys, deep with lush grass, brilliant with heather, meadowsweet, scabious, and harebells. Sleek cattle graze the rich grass, and I saw that all the little flats of land had once been handworked in lazy beds. Learned men, who've never been there, have said that Eilidh Kinnaird could not have been the monastery of Hinbar because it is too bleak a spot. Spontaneously, the boatman expressed all the island really is by remarking that with this island and its cattle, you would scorn to call the king your cousin. Nobody now lives there, but the cattle are sent to graze there. It's not so long ago since people were on these islands, and the ruins of the old Celtic monastery have been much changed in adapting them to secular use. Two huge beehive houses, a kiln for drying corn, and a winnowing house are among the ruins. Most exciting is the old chapel. Its stone roof gone, but its walls, topped to the rough of heather in full flower, are still there. It could be as old as Colum Killer's time, could be the very place where the Mass of the Saints I described earlier was celebrated. Another boat came into the tiny harbour while we were there, the men, Scots fashion, in kilts, and the women in slacks. I paused beside the ice-cold well of Colum Killer at the beachhead, and one of the new arrivals immediately tendered a cup. I drank the sparkling water and then turned to begin the long journey home. Only just as I got back to Coon Ferry into the car did the weather break, and then I drove on through roads awash and with the mountain streams, which were mere trickles in the morning, running in full spate.
Daphne Poachin Mould. And that's it for Seascapes for this week. We're not here next Friday, but we'll be back in 2 weeks' time when we'll have more from the archives. And if you're free and near Dublin on Christmas Eve, come along with me to the RNLI commemoration on Dunleary Pier. It marked the anniversary of the 1895 disaster when 15 volunteer lifeboat crew lost their lives. It's a beautiful ceremony at midday at the end of the pier. I'd like to wish all our listeners everywhere across the world a happy Christmas and a very happy New Year.